We're reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila, chapter 19. The Lord instructs Srila Rupa Goswami, verse 10, I believe. Sri Rupa Shunila Prabhur Niladri Gamana.
Sri Rupa Shunila Prabhur Niladri Gamana.
Vanapate Jabin Prabhu Sri Vrindavana. Vanapate Jabin Prabhu Sri Vrindavana. Sri Rupa Sunila Prabhu Niladri Gamana. Vanapate Javan Prabhu Sri Vrindavana. Translation by His Divine Grace H.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Sri Rupa Goswami heard that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had returned to Jagannath Puri and was preparing to go to Vrindavan through the forest. There's no purport to that, but I'm wondering. Because, as I remember, last week we ended with text number 5. You remember that? So maybe we should back up a little bit. In that verse we read that the brahmanas performed religious ceremonies and chanted the holy name of Krishna, so that the two brothers, which two brothers? Rupa and Sanatana, might attain shelter at the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu very soon. And then, short purport, Prabhupada explains what is Puras Charana. Sri Rupa Gosai Tabe Naukate Bariya Apanar Ghare Aila Bahudana Laya. At this time, Sri Rupa Goswami returned home, taking with him large quantities of riches loaded in boats. Brahmana Vaishnava Dila Tara Ardhadane Akka Choti Dhanna Dila Kutumba Bharane. Srila Rupa Goswami divided the wealth that he brought back home. He gave 50% in charity to Brahmanas and Vaishnavas and 25% to his relatives. And there's a short purport. This is a practical example of how one should divide his money and retire from household life. 50% of one's money should be distributed to qualified and pure devotees of the Lord. 25% may be given to family members, and 25% may be kept for personal use in case of emergency. Well, there you go. Danda bandalagi choti sanchai karila bhala bhala viprastane stapya rakhila. He, that is Rupa Goswami, kept one-fourth of his wealth with a respectable brahmana. He kept one-fourth of his wealth with a respectable brahmana. He kept this for his personal safety because he was expecting some legal complications. Gaude rakila mudra dashahajare shonatan bhaya kore rakke murigare. He deposited 10,000 coins, which were later spent by Sri Sanatan Goswami in the custody of a local Bengali grocer. Yeah, that's what it says. Well, let's see what we can say about these things. A little about economics in the Chaitanya Charitamrita might be a topic of discussion. Sometimes we hear about money in Chaitanya Charitamrita. We hear about debts. Maybe you all can help me remember the details.
there's an occasion in Puri when the idea comes up that Advaita Acharya has a debt to be repaid, 500 rupees or something. And when Mahaprabhu hears this, if I remember correctly, he becomes quite angry at whoever it is who's saying that there's a debt. Do you anyone remember the details of this? He's quite angry, the point being that how can the Supreme Personality of Godhead be in debt? There's no question of, because he is Lord Vishnu, partially Shiva as well, so, and Vishnu is consort is Lakshmi Devi, so what's the problem? And in this way, I don't know how it's resolved in detail, but that issue comes up. And then later, toward the end of Chaitanya Charitamrita, there is a discussion about Gopinath Patanayaka having become implicated in some sort of improper dealings, some, sounds like a kind of embezzlement. He's been embezzling government funds, and the king is angry, and another government servant, again, I'm not remembering details, but there's an attempt to wreak revenge on Gopinath Patanayaka because he's disrespected someone else, and or seemed to be disrespecting someone else, and so he's to be killed. And then they describe this horrible method of punishment of death by dropping someone onto some spikes which are set up. Sounds pretty gruesome. And then they come to Lord Chaitanya to try to mediate. You know, please, Mahaprabhu, please. Here's this devotee. He was a Vaishnava. Please, you know, save him. And devotees were, you know, desperately wanting his help. And Lord Chaitanya said, don't get me involved in these matters. You know, this is all mundane affairs to do with the government and finances and taxes and all these things. He said, I'm a renunciant. I have nothing to do with these things. Don't bother me. But what should we do? What should we do? Pray to Krishna. And that's what they do, and somehow or other, by Krishna's grace, he's released from the trouble. And here we hear about Rupa Goswami, and we understand he amassed considerable wealth as one of the secretaries of the Nawab Hussein Shah. These kings of North India, these Muslim kings, this was how were they making their money? Well, of course, by taxation, but also by plundering. This was standard practice. This was how do you maintain your kingdom? You expand it. You go out and fight, and you defeat the neighboring kings, and you rob them. And this was a major motivation for the invasions that came in North India from around the 8th or 9th century, I think, of the Common Era. And there are actually rules in Islamic tradition. I don't know if it's directly in the Quran or not, but how to divide up the booty of war. What percentage goes to whom? So this was just part of the practice. This is how you... this was economy. It's not so much different from modern economy, although now it's all covered up by layers of what we call civilization, the corporate, the way corporations work basically is that they expand. They can't survive unless they expand. And expanding corporation means they have to be involved in some sort of exploitation. That's just how it works. And this one film, you can find it somewhere on the internet, has analyzed how, because legally a corporation is a legal person. That's how it works. Have you seen this? So a legal person. So they analyze how as a legal person, what kind of person? A psychopathic person, by definition of psychopath. And observing the behavior of corporations, how they work in the world, you can see that they're actually psychopathic. In other words, they don't care. In order to expand, they have to exploit. In order to exploit, they have to, you know, just be ruthless in various ways. So, money and value. In relation to renunciation, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, this is an interesting theme. We're talking in our class about relation between renunciation and bhakti. And in some ways, perhaps related to that is renunciation and money. So here we have a renunciant or an aspiring renunciant. Rupa Goswami has decided, he and Sanatana, to give up everything and join Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Actually, they want to meet him in Vrindavan. That's what today's verse is about. They hear that he's on his way to Vrindavan, and they will eventually meet him, not in Vrindavan, but after Mahaprabhu has gone to Vrindavan and he's on his way back. He will first go to Prayag, where he will meet Rupa Goswami, and he will give him instruction, and then following the Ganga east, and Sanatana Goswami coming later west, north and west, having gotten himself out of prison or whatever, this confinement that he was in, by bribery, remember, with the money. It mentions here, he's going to spend this money of Rupa Goswami in order to get himself free, to bribe himself free. So they will eventually meet. Sanatana meets Chaitanya Mahaprabhu where? Benares, exactly. So for 2 months in Benares, Mahaprabhu instructs Sanatana Goswami, and then Rupa and Sanatana, they continue on to Vrindavan, following the order of Mahaprabhu to go there, and then Mahaprabhu returns to Puri. But the theme here is money and wealth, and more broadly value. Rupa Goswami gives up everything except 25%, and well, there's a, one gets the impression for him 25% was a fair amount of money. The interesting thing I find here is, and we get no explanation of this, he's expecting some legal problems. One may wonder what sort of legal problems, because legal problems usually have to do with property. Whatever it is, we don't get any explanation, but in any case, the proportions are told here, how much he gave in charity to Brahmins and Vaishnavas, how much he gave to relatives, how much he kept for himself. And then, eventually, many years later, in Vrindavan, so much wealth is going to come to him in the form of the building of the temple of Govindaji. And that temple is one of the largest temples in North India. It's interesting that wealth tends to go toward renunciation. it tends to go toward the persons who are renounced one way or another. Also, historically, in North India, the historians tell us there was quite a development of Buddhist monastic orders in North India in early times. They became quite wealthy. Why? Because it was understood that in the Buddhist tradition, how do you make punya? How to gain piety for oneself in Buddhism? Give to the monks. You give charity to the monks. And so this was taken very seriously in early Buddhist North India, and lots of people would give their wealth or a good portion of it to the monks. And what do the monks do with it? Well, they build nice fancy monasteries. In China, this became a problem. The big landowners wanted to avoid paying taxes to the government. So how to get around paying tax to the government? Donate your land to the Buddhist monastery, but you make a deal with them and you say, okay, this is your land, right? But I'm going to manage it, okay? So they kind of kept it for themselves and simultaneously gave. And so the monasteries in China had huge lands, and the government was starting to choke on lack of taxes. And so at one point the government said, okay, that's it, finished, no more Buddhism. Yeah, that's Chinese style, you know. They just smashed, this is, I can't remember, I think early, like 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, I don't remember exactly. Shishi Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. More recent times, in Germany, amongst the Hare Krishnas, we're going back to ancient Hare Krishna history of Germany, the year 1975. Devotees fan out all over Germany to distribute the mercy and to collect the mercy. And they have a mantra, very powerful mantra. The mantra is, please give a donation for helping to feed poor children in Bangladesh. Uh-oh. Yep, that was the mantra. And we had pictures. See, none of the money, of course, was going to Bangladesh, or maybe, I don't know if even a fraction, maybe something was going to Mayapur, I don't know. I was just a simple brahmachari back then, didn't know how things were managed. But one day, one Sunday morning, I wasn't there, I was in Denmark at the time, but one Sunday morning when all the devotees were together in the temple in Schloss Reddershof, the police surrounded the temple with I don't know how many police cars. And they arrested everybody. And they froze the accounts. And anyway, long sad story. They confiscated the money, which had by that time come up to an amount of some over 700,000 Deutschmarks. They confiscated it, and they kept it. Yeah, after so many trials, I mean, big trial, and so much bad newspaper coverage. Ooh, heavy newspaper coverage. Anyway, Hare Krishnas are still there. life goes on. But this collection of funds by monks has always been something of an issue in history. Also, going back a little earlier in French history, probably you know more than I do, but I'm thinking about the Franciscans. Franciscan monks in early times following Saint Francis, they would go barefoot, and their rule was to live in poverty, so they were living like that, but again, money tends to come to, or wealth tends to come where there is renunciation, and then eventually as I read one time, the Franciscan order kind of split in two. There were those who said, no, the standard that we received, the teachings from our Saint Francis, are absolute poverty, no ownership. And the other side said, well, you know, let's not be fanatical. So, so that sort of thing is always going on. But more broadly, the question for devotees is, what exactly is wealth, and what is value? In general, there are two sorts of value. There's the kind of value that can be measured in terms of some sort of what's called exchange value. You have something like money, or you have some kind of goods, and you can do some kind of exchange. You can measure the value of something. And an interesting sort of feature of modern life seems to be that more and more things which were in earlier times possibly not given a measurable value are given a measurable value. It's come to the point that pretty much everything is up for sale. You can buy, you know, pretty much anything. Although there have been times when you could also buy people. It's called slavery. You could buy and sell people. Actually, it wasn't so long ago, I read this on Wikipedia, that you could a man could sell his wife in England, and sometimes she was sold for a very small amount. It was easier than divorce. It was legally, we've had enough of this marriage, then it was easier to sell the wife by auction than to go through a divorce. So, you know, just put up for auction and have some money in return. As late as the 19th century, apparently, in England. But more in 18th century, as far as I remember, this is going on. So we hear about this and think, oh, that's outrageous. Or maybe someone's thinking, maybe that's not so outrageous. But yeah, why do we think that's outrageous? Because the idea of putting a value, an amount, a measurable value on a person is outrageous. And why is that? My theory is the reason that is because we implicitly understand that persons are eternal. Because the difference between something that we very customarily put value on, that you can buy and sell things, they're always temporal. You can buy a box of apples. Why? Because at some point those apples are going to rot and they're going to be pretty much valueless or whatever. Something you can buy is something which eventually will no longer be. And so persons are not like that. Persons are eternal, and so they are, this is one way of understanding that they are beyond measurable value. So that value is unlimited value. And so the renunciant is the person who fully understands this point, and recognizing this point is able to see that real